Mariana can do that. Thank you, Mariana. And so we are now recording the meeting, and we can have that be our approach going forward. And so, Cherie, just a couple of things, other things that you brought up. So at the December 17th meeting, I just want to say, I know that we're off agenda, and we will take as much time as we need, particularly because my assessment of one of the things that's going on is that the group was rather new and we were still in formation, and then this very unexpected, unprecedented thing happened, right? Which then completely interrupted our momentum and the work that we were doing together. So I realize that these are very difficult circumstances that we find ourselves in. But just to highlight a couple of things that Cherie brought up, and that is the draft charter came before the SHAC in December, and we discussed it and we made several changes based on the discussion in December, and then brought back a revision on the 18th of February. And then we did hold a consensus vote, and that is, we asked if there were any additional changes, if there was, and if there were any objections to the charter, and there was, at that time, there was not any, and it was approved by unanimous consent. That is the decision-making rule that we have in place here. If and by no means is a consensus a decision rule that cannot and does not capture differences. And so if you'd like for, in the discussions, for me as a facilitator to put a finer point on that, and to and to maybe even just slow down and take more time, we certainly can do that. But that was what my recollection was of the how the charter went, discussion went. And but to be clear, that there, this charter can be modified, and then if the SHAC would like it to be, and then it would need to go back to the GSA board. That is certainly something we can do. I'd like to hear views of other SHAC members, if any, related to our discussion related to the charter decision making, or any other comments that you might have about the content of the February 18th summary, or the level of detail that you would like to see in those summaries. Other SHAC members who have not yet spoken, who'd like to weigh in, please raise your hand. And if you're on the phone, go ahead and speak. Bruce?
Yeah, I nowhere on my screen do I see somewhere where I can raise my hand that was similar to what I was being shown before. But aside from that, I agree with Samantha and Gary and Greg, and we left the meeting. Actually, it went overtime, but we all know we left, and I don't remember any consensus vote on what Samantha talked about. I agree with her that it was left up, and I had thought we were going to bring this back up now. I too am very, this is my third Zoom. It has disrupted the first two that I had with other things, and this Zoom is, I know it's an attempt, but in my opinion, this is a disgusting way to meet. Anyway.
Yeah. You know, Bruce, I totally hear that, you know, and we'll have to we'll have to see what value it has, what can be done in this format, what can't. And I hear you about that. I just want to clarify, when you say that you agree with that, with Samantha, that were you referring to the out-of-basin transfer document, that there wasn't a consensus vote, or the charter? Or so just clarify that for me a little bit.
I agree with Samantha on the out-of-basin transfer, but also that charter was written prior to coronavirus changing of everything. that's going on. So I would strongly suggest that we, if this is the way things are going to be, we're going to have to adjust even the charter, because it, there was no way back then that we had any idea of how things were going to be today. And so I would say we have to review the charter and the out-of-basin transfer discussion.
Yeah, that was super helpful what you just said, Bruce, because I think that that context is really important. So I think we have a plan with the out-of-basin transfer rule that we are going to send that out right for comment, and then we will bring it back to be agendized. So we will address that. And regarding the charter, you helped me to understand more deeply what some of the thoughts are that a lot, I mean, really, we're in a whole new world here. A lot has changed since we last looked at this charter, and it may require another look if we find ourselves needing to meet online. And I noticed, you know, just yesterday, because I'm in the middle of a major water negotiation, and we added to that charter of that group a note about COVID, and because of this very thing that and so that's a really interesting idea. So let's think about let's think a little bit more about that and maybe bring some draft language about to help us have a conversation about what it actually means for decision making and for how the shack operates in this new coronavirus world. Other shack members, any comments or questions about anything that we've discussed so far related to decision making and the documentation of the meetings? All right, we've taken several actions away from this, and I think we're gonna try again. We're gonna continue to do our best to hit the mark here, and we're going to add greater detail to the meeting summaries, and we're gonna bring those back to you to say, does this hit the mark? Is this what you'd like to see? We are recording the meetings. Those recorded files will be available and can be posted as MP4 files on the VINA GSA website under the SHAC meetings. And we have actions associated with the out-of-basin transfer rule. I'd like to just, I'm going to close the this document, and then to bring back the summary, because I don't think that we've closed the loop on the meeting summary here. So we've had suggested language, and I think that there is agreement among the SHAC members. And I'm going to check in to see if anyone does not agree that we should clarify in the meeting summary that there was not enough time to complete this discussion, and that the SHAC requested for the out-of-basin transfer rule document to come back for the SHAC's discussion, and then to put nuance to that here. Christina, I see that your hand is up. I'll come to you in a moment. It looks like you may have put your hand down, though. And then we will add a bullet to that effect in the discussion section of the out-of-basin transfer rule process. So aside from those changes, so that means that we're not finalizing this agenda yet, I mean this meeting summary yet, because we're going to make those refinements, and then we need to bring it back to you along with today's meeting summary, which will have greater detail. Anything else, though, that we should capture in the February 18th meeting summary for us to make sure that we add for your review the next time we meet?
Tanya, sorry for the interruption, but there was a comment about a number that was added later on. We can It's 530-896-7241. It hasn't been identified yet.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So can you unmute yourself, either star six or manual unmuting 530-896-7241? 530-896-7241. Please unmute, either star six or just manually unmute your phone. Hi.
Hi, it's Linda Herman. Sorry.
Hi,
can
Linda.
You hear me now?
Yeah.
So sure. I had to do the star six, so that was new. I thought I could just unmute on my phone, so I know now to do the star six. So it's me, Linda Herman.
Thanks, Linda. Sometimes it works either way. Thank you. And sometimes it doesn't. Thanks, Linda. You can go ahead and put yourself on mute, Linda Herman, with the city of Chico. All right. Going back to my question to SHAC members, any other changes to the February 18th meeting summary? I'm just waiting a moment to see if you have hands raised. And those of you who can't, who are on the phone, who are SHAC members, any other changes? Okay, well, I appreciate the time that we took on this because I think it was important. And for those of you who are new to participating as members of the public with the SHAC, I hope you understand the context of this discussion, which is that the group was quite new before the coronavirus hit, and then everything sort of changed, and we've been on hold for a couple of months. And so I think it's helping us to regroup and sort of rethink some things. And so I think it was important to take that time. thank you all. I'm going to close the summary. We will make those changes. And I want to revisit the agenda now, given that we are going to have to make some adjustments to see how we'd like to proceed.
I can't get a star on you or a hand. I don't know where it went to, but
Gary,
I'm still a little bit not clear before we leave this, since I think we as SHAC members need to be able to vote on minutes and show a voting hand. And from your summary, it doesn't seem like you are attempting to address that issue at all or bring it back up again. And is that your intention, not to ever talk about that again and we just don't get to vote or show a vote?
Well, so Gary, if that is something that the SHAC is interested in doing, then we would have to, we will need to look at the charter, not only for what Bruce suggested by, adding some language about what it means to participate within coronavirus environment and in when we have online meetings, let's say, but it would need to specify, if the group is not, we'll have to talk more about decision-making. If right now it reads, as I read, that it is a consensus-seeking group, that doesn't mean that you can't attribute, you can't say, okay, we can call for, we can go around the room when we call for consensus to say, is there any objection to this recommendation or this action? And if someone objects or feels that they can't live with it, then what are the reasons for that? Where is there agreement and where is there disagreement? So essentially it is a vote. The ultimate decision-making lies with the VINA GSA board. The SHAC, as its name suggests, is an advisory committee. So when it gives formal advice, we see if there's unanimous consent and no one does object to a particular recommendation or have any concerns, then we communicate that. If there are different perspectives and folks are concerned, then we document those and we communicate that with detail to the GSA board. We just haven't had a formal recommendation yet. We would do that, and we would communicate that as is consistent with how the the charter currently reads. Is there something that I'm missing of that you would like to see?
No, I'm just very concerned that we're having this committee, but we're not behaving like a committee and normally would be, and rules under the Brown Act we're responsible for and all of this, but then we don't even keep minutes per se. We have a summary. I understand that this is under the control of someone else.
Well, we can take minutes. We can provide more detail in the form of minutes if that is something that the group would like to do. And I'd like to be able to send the next summary to you, the next meeting notes to you with more detail, and then see if that hits the mark.
All right.
Start to respond to your concern?
That'll be a good start, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. I see Paul's hand was up first and then Samantha. Paul?
Yeah, I'd just like to add, and I think that these are real good points, and I think the break we had was not the best in circumstances to keep momentum, but a lot of these rules were put in place, you know, before we got going. So I think it, you know, is something that we probably should agendize for the next meeting. Along with the review of a lot more detailed meeting summary. So the SHAC can weigh in and maybe come up with recommendations on, you know, modifying the charter. And I think we need to keep this dynamic and reflective of how things unfold. So I think to Gary's point, yeah, I don't think we should walk away from this. I think we can, you know, broaden this out under the existing charter, but I think maybe agendize it and bring it back, because you know that's going to delay some other things on the schedule. But if we don't get this right and the SHAC isn't comfortable with how things are going, then it is really going to harm the rest of the process. So I think it's important to really get everyone on board on this.
Excellent.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. I think you've just said what we're trying to express ourselves.
Thank you. Thank you, Samantha. Okay, so we are going to agendize this for the next meeting. We'll bring you more detailed meeting notes, and we will consider modifying the charter based on the input that we've received. Any other SHAC members have comments or questions related to what we've discussed? Okay, thank you. All right, I'd like to revisit the agenda because we are going to have to make some adjustments. And what I think maybe we certainly won't be able to get through the entire presentation, and that's fine. And so I just would like for Byron, for you to be sort of thinking about what might be a good stopping point with the for the presentation, right? And so we'll go partway through, and then we will revisit it depending on how that goes. Before we do that, I'd like to make sure that we go to the public comment. As is consistent with the Brown Act, you can see this if you are viewing your screen, you can see this in front of you. And if you are on the phone, I'll just read what it says on the agenda, that this is public comment for items not on the agenda. The public will have an opportunity to comment on items that are not on the agenda and that are relevant to the VINA Groundwater Subbasin Stakeholder Advisory Committee. SHAC committee members are not required to respond to any issues raised during the public comment period and may not take any action on such issues other than to refer to the item or schedule the issues for a future agenda. The public is asked not to exceed 3 minutes when making remarks. And the public will also have an opportunity to make remarks at the end of each agenda topic. So I'll just turn to any members of the public who have would like to bring up any items that are relevant to the shack but aren't currently on today's agenda. Please raise your hand, and if you're on the phone, go ahead and speak up. So Jim, you are a shack member. I'd like to just go to members of the public, and then I can come to shack members in a moment. Any members of the public would like to make comment? Okay, and I don't see any hands up, and I'm not hearing anything. So Jim, you have your hand raised. Is there something you'd like to bring up?
Yes, I bring it up because it's not on the agenda. I recognize I'm a member of the shack. I don't see a place on there to amend the agenda to discuss this, but I held off till now. There's been a bit of discussion already on how uncomfortable some people are using this webinar as a manner of meeting. One of my questions is the Brown Act requires that meetings and agendas will be posted in accordance with the Brown Act. And I understand because of security reasons, you don't want this Zoom call to be too widely distributed. And in the past, we're encouraging public participation as required by holding the meetings in a public spot in that conference room in the old municipal building. It was large enough to accommodate quite a good crowd. People did attend from the public. And I wonder how the meeting agendas are being posted in accordance with the Brown Act now in order to follow this requirement of encouraging public participation in the shack meetings.
Yes, thank you for the question. And Cami, do you want to speak to this? And then any other member of the management committee can also speak to how we're approaching this.
Let me turn on my video, sorry. With regard to posting, we've been posting the agenda and the agenda packet online. Is that specifically what you want me to refer to, Tanya? Is that what you're thinking?
Go ahead, yes.
And then we post that on the Thursday before the shack meeting, and then each member agency is posting it at either their office. We posted at DID's office as well.
When you post it online, what is the avenue of posting that you do it on?
We use, so we have our Vina GSA website, and okay. So it has, which is done in compliance with, I forget, just the different laws and rules of how that should look. So you have the vinagsa.org website, and there is a section for both board meetings as well as shack meetings.
And does it give the link to get into this Zoom meeting on those postings?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Nonetheless, it is bulky. You know, we spent so much time at the beginning just getting a tutoring on how to use Zoom. And I suppose every time we get new participants, that's going to happen. It happens a lot quicker if we're actually sitting in a meeting with a chairperson or a facilitator. So I'm wondering if it's possible to actually delay these meetings, as some meetings are being delayed, because we do have a couple of years to put this together. Now, no one knows how long this social distancing is going to occur, but there are other meetings that are being delayed. And if the meetings continue to be as bulky and as minimally productive as this is, I'm wondering if we're considering delaying meetings until we can actually have open public in-person meetings again. So mm-hmm. It's just something maybe for the management committee to consider. I know we don't want to break our momentum, but the county can continue doing monitoring process. Members can continue to communicate with staff. to continue to expand our data collection and that sort of thing. But I just wanted to express my concern that the public is not able to really participate in a meaningful way in this process.
Thank you, Jim. Just to be really clear about what we do, to add to what Cami said, and I think Paul might have something to add. I've pulled up the Vina GSA website and I've gone to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee meetings, and you can see that we include in the agenda all of the how to access the online meeting, and we pull it out at the top of the announcements. The interested parties list also receives a notification with this online meeting information, as well as a link to this location on the website, which then has all the meeting materials. Now, Brown Act requires for all meeting materials to be posted at least 72 hours before, and that's why we try to post by 9 a.m. the Thursday before. And Brown Act says that if the agency is producing materials, those need to be provided 72 hours before. If there's a third party consultant, they need to make those materials available the day of the meeting and then post after. But because of this online meeting situation, we've made the decision to make sure that all meeting materials, including those provided by a consultant like David's Engineering, that those are posted in advance as well, both to give people some time to digest the materials and also for those people who can't actually access the online interface so that they have those materials in front of them before the meeting. And so those are some of the things that we've done to try to just sort of address the current situation that we're in. Paul, did you have something to add to that? And then I want to make sure that I am sharing some comments from the chat. Paul?
Yeah, just a couple quick thoughts. And Jim's point, I think from the management committee, we were just as concerned about how to proceed ahead. I mean, we canceled two meetings. We really only have, unless things change for the deadlines for Sigma, we have just over a year to start buttoning up the GSP. So, you know, this format isn't really conducive. And I think at the end, after we get through this, I think really wanting to hear your reaction to this. You know, it is an information meeting, which we thought was at least a good, safe way to start. But once we start getting into real heavy issues that require interaction, recommendations, you know, we're going to need to get some input on this format and whether it's conducive. So I think we're definitely sharing your concerns about this, but wanted to give this at least information sharing a start and get some feedback. So I think the debrief at the end is going to be real important for us.
Thank you, Paul. Christina?
I don't need to add anything else to that. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so thanks, Jim, for the question. And I did was just showing you the Vina GSA website there.
I appreciate that. And one more comment on the posting of material. I do spend quite a bit of time reviewing the material ahead of time. There's a lot of material that gets sent out, especially in the presentations. So I was surprised and somewhat dismayed when yesterday I received a notice that the four postings from David's Engineering has been edited and redistributed. I downloaded it and tried to review it as fast as I could, but I couldn't quite tell exactly, you know, without reading everything and hours of detail, where the changes were. So I encourage all the meeting materials to actually be finalized well ahead of time rather than editing them and sending out revised copies the day before, because it didn't give me time to quite discern what got revised. I think it's really important for those of us who take this seriously to really study the material and be able to take our notes and our questions and that sort of thing. So
Can I respond to that?
Please.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the reason that we went ahead and did that is the things that were updated, it's the same slide deck. A couple numbers on calibration were updated. Really, it was just minute detail, which, and I appreciate your advanced review. And for anyone else that did an advanced review, it really wouldn't have changed what you would have digested mostly. So, and yet we wanted anyone that logged on this morning and was going to look at the presentation, we wanted them to be able to look at the same thing that would be toggled through by Byron and others. So, you know, we're doing the best we can, but that if it had been, we would not significantly change things because that would kind of throw off the pre-review that is our intent of making those available in advance. So
yeah,
I hope that helps.
Christina, thank you. And of course, Jim, I think we could have said that too, right, when we sent them back out to say, right, to say that we have only made minimal changes and you'll notice changes on slide numbers, blah, 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 right, and given you that information, and then also provided the context to say we're sending them out again, even though there are minor changes, because we want to make sure that anyone who can't actually see the presentation during today's meeting because they can't join via the Zoom login has the same slide deck, right? And so it's just important, especially in this current environment that we're in, to provide that contextual background. Thank you for the comment and those points. It's helping us all figure this out. Samantha, I see your hand.
Yeah, just touching back on something Paul brought up, what effort has there been to start talking about extending the Sigma deadlines? I know that the state was quick to pass some legislation to extend the real ID deadlines at the DMV. And I mean, we're into this meeting an hour and a half and we're still talking about the attachments. I mean, I personally was not able to print out the presentation because it's 62 pages long in color. So yeah, I would support talking about getting our deadlines extended because of this extenuating circumstance that we're in.
Paul, thank you, Samantha. Paul?
Yeah, there have been some discussions with some of the associations, the county association, water associations, about extending the deadline. And part of it was to try to get a sense of how these kind of meetings went. You know, we hadn't done one of these. We kind of knew they were probably going to have some issues, but we wanted to at least give it a trial run. But as this continues, my feeling, I think a lot of other managers around the different GSAs look at this engagement that's a high bar for Sigma is not really going to be conducive in online format. And if this continues for a while, well, it looks like it will, even under stage two or even moving into stage three, we're going to have some issues. So there have been some discussions among the associations about extending a deadline. So again, at the debrief, if that's kind of where the sense of the shack is, that's going to be important to know and to try to push that along from stakeholders up to try to get an extension. They did extend and sort of waived a number of things under this emergency order, but there was a number of things that have not, that are continuing, and Sigma is one of them that has not changed, but that obviously can be changed.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul. I'm just taking a look at the chat and just want to call that to people's attention because there has been some information shared in the chat. I'm going to review a few things if you're not seeing that. Kelly shared that the only recommendation the SHAC has sent up to the GSA board is approval of the charter with the February revisions as agreed to by the SHAC in February. We've discussed that we are in the new coronavirus environment going to agendize and relook at that. Mariana did share the vinagsa.org web address. Kelly said to everyone, please contact me. And she's provided her email address for assistance in being added to the large email distribution list that will inform you when the materials are available and with a link to them. Of course, we send that directly to the Shack, but for everyone else, if you would like to be on the interested parties list, contact kpeterson@buttecounty.net. And Chris Madden shared with the Shack, I actually believe that we have more public participants on this Zoom meeting than we had at either of the previous physical meetings. Cherie has said, I agree with Chris. I prefer these virtual meetings and have such seen much more public participation in all the meetings that I have been on. One observation about that, and I think I mentioned it earlier, with I work with an organization that works throughout California nationally and also internationally, and we had to completely acknowledge that this is not an ideal format for particularly certain kinds of conversations. And it's really up to the group, it's important for us to have a conversation about what's working and what's not working. But one of the positive sides that we have noticed is that we have seen a significant uptick in participation in these meetings because people don't have to travel and take as much time. That isn't the same thing as, you know, quality of discussion and participation. So it sort of cuts both ways. But just to say, we've seen a significant increase in actual participation in these online meetings throughout the country. Thank you, everyone. And looking again at our agenda, I would like for us to, we're going to make some adjustments. And I'd like to allow for us to take a 5-minute bio break for folks who may just need to get up and get a glass of water, take care of whatever you need to take care of. And then please stay on the Zoom. Don't leave the Zoom. You can turn off your video if you'd like to just take a quick break. Byron, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Byron. I just want to check in with you while we're on this break. So everyone, please come back at 10:35, but please do not log off of Zoom. Just stay put. Byron, I just want to check in with you, and if Christina is here as well, about how you'd like to. We will come back at 10:35. I see someone noting the time. Byron and Christina, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Great. So I just want us to take a minute, excuse me, please, to take a minute to regroup about how we'd like to proceed with the presentation component. We do want to stop, I think, by 11:40. We're basically going to have an hour. So what's the priority? How should we move forward?
Well, I think this has been all very good and important discussion this morning that is absolutely essential to the process. Looking at the kind of the technical topics that we laid out here, what I would suggest, you know, for consideration by the Shack and discussion with Christina and others, is that we perhaps shorten the 9:30 item just to provide a real brief overview of where we're at in the process of developing the GSP content. Maybe try to keep that to 5 minutes, but of course allow for discussion and questions. And then also perhaps try to shorten the Butte Basin groundwater model status section a bit, maybe by 5 minutes. Again, also allowing for any additional discussion needed. And then try to cover the historical groundwater conditions and water budget results. It will probably need to be a bit abbreviated also. I mean, that would leave 40 minutes for that topic, essentially, correct? As opposed to 50, which we had originally planned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we can see how far we get with the historical groundwater conditions and water budget results. I imagine there would be a lot of questions about that item. And so after the meeting, we can regroup, and depending on how the group wants to proceed, then we can resume the next discussion, right, to make sure that we complete our conversation on that topic. But Christina, what are your thoughts about what Byron has proposed?
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, that outline, the GSP is really for reference, so we can touch on that quickly. And depending on the Shack's interest in the Butte Basin modeling details, that's a topic really in and of itself that we could dive deeper on, so in the future. So yeah, I would agree with the suggestion that we can revisit that if there's interest. But I would like to see us be able to really get through the historical water budget information.
Okay, thank you. So if you needed just a couple of minutes, I'm gonna go get a glass of water myself, but if you needed just a couple of minutes, I wanted to let you go. And then we can start up at 10:35. Does that sound okay?
I'll be right back.
Sounds good.
Thank you. Okay, it's 10:35. I'd like for us to get started again. If you're able to turn your video back on, for those of you who are on video. All right, I had a chance, and some of you may have overheard the discussion, that the brief conversation that Byron Clark with David's Engineering and Christina Buck, Assistant Director of Butte County Water, and resource conservation. And I had to revisit the amount of time that we have remaining today and to make some changes a proposed approach for the rest of our discussion today. And so what we'd like to do is we'd like to see if it's possible for us to get to a completion with our get through the historical groundwater conditions and water budget results presentation. Of course, if we don't get all the way there, then we will resume our discussion of that topic the next time we meet. but first, we'd like to just take a few minutes. We sent you an outline of the Groundwater Sustainability Plan chapters. And the reason that we sent this outline was because the last time we met, the SHAC wanted to get a sense of sort of how this all fit together. And we said that we would share this outline. It's really here just for your reference. And I'm going to just pull up that document here. Christina, is there anything that you'd like to say about the abbreviated potential GSP outline?
Really just that you can see kind of, you know, the five main pieces of the plan. This is based on the regulations, the GSP regulations. And I've highlighted in yellow the sections that are being tackled by the basin setting project, which is what David's engineering team has been working on. And so today we were really hoping to give you an update and the preliminary results of the water budget information and some of the groundwater conditions. And then you'll see that other pieces are coming in the near future. And then the rest of it is really what we're tasked with under the next contract GSP completion over the course of the next year. So hopefully that just provides some context of where we're at, what you're going to hear today. And sit tight for kind of these other pieces that are coming.
Thank you, Christina. I'll go to the SHAC members to see if you have any questions related to the GSP outline, and then I'll go to the public to see if you have any questions of Christina, remembering that this is really just to show you the what the regulations require for GSP planning and the highlighted areas illustrating what we intend to discuss today. So first, SHAC members, I see, Jim, that you have your hand up. If there are other SHAC members who have questions, please do raise your hand. Jim?
Yes, on the hydrogeologic conceptual model, on the full version of it, it's got several bullet points, and one of them that's really important to me is the delineation of existing recharge areas that substantially contribute to replenishment of the basin. And the basin that we're talking about is substantially Tuscan aquifer. The pressurized lower aquifer is the recharge area is not, as far as we know, within the basin itself, but it actually has yet to be determined how the lower Tuscan, which is in my opinion the foundation of this entire system that we're trying to protect, that we need to figure out where the recharge areas actually are. Now, I'm not talking about the shallow, the alluvial aquifer, but the deeper aquifer. And we need the California or Butte County or someone really needs to invest the resources necessary to delineate where the recharge area is for the pressurized portion of the aquifer. And so I appreciate having the abbreviated version, but I think it's really important to look at the full version that was put out by the DWR. So we understand all the different things that are required in order to have a clear hydrogeological conceptual model, especially as we're going into water budgets. Because where's the water coming from? How are we going to protect the source of the water coming in? We need to know where the recharge, what the recharge mechanism and the recharge areas are. That's my comment.
Okay, thank you, Jim. So what I gathered from that is that you're interested in seeing a detailed GSP outline as produced by DWR. Christina, do you have any thoughts or comments to add?
I made a note of that under that HCM topic, and we'll cover that when we dive into that deeper next time.
Okay, thank you very much. Other SHAC members, any questions or comments, things you'd like for the team to be thinking about related to this reference piece, the GSP outline? And Jim, I'm going to lower your hand there. Okay, and any members of the public, any questions or comments on this reference document, the GSP abbreviated outline?
Tanya, could you bring up what the document looks like on your screen, please?
I'm sorry, are you not seeing it?
This is Linda Cole here, a member of the public. And on the issue of recharge areas to the deeper Tuscan area, I, at a previous meeting, asked for consideration of how the change in the water delivery through the Miocene will affect the water recharge, and was told that you were running a model now, and later you might put those changes in the input in the model. So I would like some reassurance that that factor is actually going to be researched.
Christina?
Yeah. So Miocene is mostly, I think 95% or more outside the model area. And yeah, we had talked about that before, Linda. I think we're getting a better hand as the Miocene project goes forward, and in terms of addressing those water supply issues, we're getting a better idea of how much water we're talking about. And in the context of a regional model, it just is kind of beyond what is significant and what you would even see. But
well, the reason why I'm asking is because from what I heard, the question was, are we going to have some idea of where the recharge for the deeper aquifer is? And when PG&E was running water and through Coal Canyon Power Plant, some of that water did come this way into an area that was impacted by the change in water management from Western Canal. So as you move forward and you're talking about water budgets, I think that it will be significant, even though when you're talking about a regional model, you're looking at a bigger area. But if proposed activities will include movement of water or substitution, then small trigger points will be an issue.
Mm-hmm. And locally, it can be important for sure. So yeah, it can be addressed outside of the model too, because maybe the model's not the right tool, or it's not going to capture it. That doesn't mean that it can't be addressed and certainly kept in, you know, in consideration in a meaningful way. So
I'm hopeful that that question and your response will be included in the minutes.
Sounds good.
Yes, I got it.
Okay, thank you, Linda. And I'm sorry, was that Samantha? Somebody requested something about a document. Samantha, was that you?
Yeah, I was hoping that you could click on the link and show the full document that's available on the screen. Why are we looking at the abbreviated version if the full is what we're addressing?
So I put together kind of this two-page abbreviated version because I think it's useful to see the main topics and just if you're interested in high level, kind of what are the major pieces of the GSP, the two-page version is there. And I've highlighted, you know, the sections that are being bit off by the basin setting project. If you want the dirty details, which are really important and will ultimately be in the GSP, then I included that link. And so that is available and is really informative and helpful to understand, you know, all of what we're going to need to address in the GSP. So that's available as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. And it was good to be able to click onto that link. And so those of you who are interested can access that. Okay, I'm realizing that this is a reference piece for us. We will revisit this so we know where we are as the GSP development process moves forward. I'd like to move on from this to the presentation. And so I'm going to stop I'm just going to check in the chat. I'm going to stop my share because Byron, I want you to be able to go ahead and share your screen.
Are you able to see it?
Yes, you go ahead and can you go ahead and put it in slideshow? Yeah.
There we go.
Looks good, Byron.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you everyone for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Byron Clark. I'm with David's Engineering based out of Davis, and we've been working with the county on the basin setting project here for the past couple of years or so, and really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to provide an update on some of the work that we've been doing, kind of focusing a bit on where the model development process is. I understand that Christina gave an overview of the model at the February SHAC meeting. So we'll try to build on that to show the current modeling status. And Christina will be talking, as well as Reza Nambar from Woodard and Curran, who's been leading the model calibration. And we'll talk a little bit about groundwater conditions within the basin and share some of the hydrographs that have been developed. And David Miller from GEI Consultants, who's on our team, will be talking about that, as well as some of the groundwater elevation contours that have been developed. And then we'll move into a discussion of the water budgets. As discussed, I think focusing on the historical water budgets for today, and just look forward to your input and discussion. These results are still draft, and so subject to uncertainty. So look forward to any feedback that you have as you see some of the information that's presented. Also, don't hesitate to raise your hand for clarifying questions along the way, and we'll also take pauses for discussion. So with that, Christina, did you want to kind of pick up kind of where things left off with the model discussion from the last check meeting before Reza talks about the calibration status?
Yeah, I think I'll mostly give it back to you, but just wanted to remind you folks that the Butte Basin groundwater model covers the extent of the three sub-basins, Bina, Wyandotte Creek, and Butte, and then a little bit beyond them to the north and south. And the western boundary is the Sacramento River, which is also the western boundary of our sub-basins and of Bina. And then just really, it's an integrator of lots of different types of data, both in the land surface system, what's going on above the ground, and in the groundwater system. And so there's some strengths there in being able to really understand kind of interrelated processes because it's all being calculated kind of in one place. But we live in a complicated world, so it's never gonna capture all of those things. And so it's a tool that we use alongside other lines of understanding that we have, other data types, but it's what we're using for estimating these water budget numbers. Some of these numbers are calculated outside of the model. If you go ahead and go forward, Byron, yeah, to this one. And they're data that we either measure, you know, or have available from other places and put into the model. And then there's other things that we're relying on the model to estimate and calculate. And those include the blue ones here, the stream groundwater interaction, groundwater pumping, and interbasin flow. So not everything that kind of comes out of the model is calculated necessarily by the model. Things like precipitation are really passed through, but are driving then some of our estimates of these other things that we don't have direct measurements for. So just wanted to remind you of that. Yeah, go ahead. And really the goal of calibrating a model is that it reflects better our understanding of the real world. We can't, you know, we don't even know exactly what that crisp picture of the real world looks like, because some of these things we don't have real numbers to compare to. So what we have to rely on those data points that we do have to see how well the model and calculated results are matching our observed or measured results. And our goal really is to have a tool that's good enough to answer the questions, our key questions. And for some questions, it won't be the right tool, and it won't be able to capture the detail that we need for that particular question. So it's good to keep that in mind as well. So I think I'll mostly skip this one, but just to say that there are things that we can refine, whether they're data inputs or parameters that affect, you know, our representation of the physical system within reasonable ranges. And one of the key things that we can compare, and this is a graph here of groundwater levels, the line is what's calculated by the model. So on this model is a daily time step. So it's estimating or calculating a daily groundwater level at this location and spitting that out. And we can compare that then to measured groundwater levels that we have at this location in a monitoring well. And we wanna see that it's doing a fairly decent job of matching up those water levels. You can see it's not perfect. What we wanna see is there's a general similarities in trends and change over time. A lot of times models do a better job of capturing change than maybe the absolute number and hitting that on the mark. And you'll see that it does a better job in some areas than in other areas. And so that is important for us to understand as well, and in how we, how much we believe its results and how we look to it to provide additional understanding and help us understand the groundwater system. So with that, I'm gonna turn it over to Reza, I believe, to give an update on the status.
Thank you, Christina. This is Reza Namvar from Woodard and Curran from our Sacramento office. I'll go briefly on the model calibration in the interest of time. You know, I'll be brief, but a lot of this information is available and we can provide more detailed information as needed in the future. The model, Butte model, is based on the historical land and water use information, and a lot of it is coming from the water inventory and analysis of June 2016 report. And our goal through the calibration was to make sure the model is reasonably estimating the groundwater levels in Wayna, Butte, and Wyandotte Creek subbasins in the area. And those, the model covers all those three subbasins and some areas outside those two. And in Wayna, there are many wells, but we picked 86 calibration wells that represents the groundwater behavior throughout last two or three decades. And we wanted to make sure we can simulate the historical conditions in the basin. And we have selected 86 wells. Byron, would you go to the next slide, please? This is a summary of the wells that have been used for calibration of the model. In Wayna Subbasin, we have 86 calibration wells. 8 of those are nested wells, and 8 are Cal Water wells near Chico area. And there are 27 key wells that are you know, identified by Butte County as the key wells for the basin to represent groundwater basin there. So the model runs from 1970s to 2018, but most recently we are looking at 1990 to 2018 to make sure all of the recent activities in the basin are covered by the model, and we can represent that correctly there. So the model, based on the land and water use information, it estimates groundwater levels, and each data point that we have measured data from each well, we get a simulated heads from the model, and the difference between those two would be the residual, and we try to keep those residuals within an acceptable range, plus minus 20 feet for a regional model. And the closer we are, the better the calibrated model it is to that range. But since there are a lot of data, then we have several statistic tools that we can look at those and make sure overall that we have the good picture of the basin. In addition to the hydrographs. Next slide, please. These are a couple of statistics that we usually use to show how well a model is calibrated. The line, the chart on the left side, it's showing the many dots of the observed values as well as the simulated heads for the same data point. And if the residual is, you know, is zero, it's gonna fall on that, you know, 45 degree line in the middle. If it's different than that, then it's gonna be either above that or we will be overestimating the water levels, or below that would be underestimating the water levels. But usually it should be somewhere in a band of 20 feet there. And similarly, you can group those residuals into a bar chart that's shown on the right-hand side. It should be very close to the plus minus 20 feet in the middle, and should be a tall bell-shaped bar chart there. In addition to the statistics, we also looked at the hydrographs. Byron, would you go to the next slide? And these are two wells in the Waena North management area, and it shows, you know, how well the model is simulating this. As I said, we are concentrating on the 1990 and beyond to make sure all of the recent activities are covered in the model. We have several different hydrographs. At each one of these 80-something wells, we have hydrographs. And for those interested, this map of hydrographs are also available in Google Earth. We can provide that to interested members of the meeting. And that could be used. You can go through the basin and pick any wells and look at the hydrographs. Most of them are simulating very good, as it's represented in here. And we can look at some others, but these are all well calibrated for a regional model. And we also looking at stream flow in the basin and simulating the stream flows and trying to match the stream flows there. I don't know, I think in the interest of time, we can skip the next two slides, the hydrographs, and go to the stream chart, slide 14. And next one, yeah. So this is another example of the hydrograph out of the model, and it shows how the model and how the model is simulating the stream flows in Big Chico Creek and Butte Creek. And there are several other points that we compare the model along the Sacramento River and other streams in the area. This is just an example how it's comparing the two observed data and simulated data. Byron, would you like to go over the next slide, the conclusion of the calibration, or would you like me to cover that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, so just to kind of summarize, where things are at right now are that we have fairly high confidence in the land surface information, so information like precipitation, evapotranspiration, surface water deliveries, particularly in the last decade or two. And that, again, is based largely on the work that was done for the Water Inventory and Analysis Report and the update to the Butte Basin Groundwater Model at that time. The calibration statistics are very good for a regional model, which we think provides a valuable tool that could be used in GSP development in the Vina Subbasin. As Christina described, maybe not appropriate for every possible use, but certainly helpful for the water budgets and other uses. We're using it to develop the water budgets. As part of next steps, the model can be used to support development of sustainable management criteria, particularly when looking at some of these things that are difficult or impossible to measure, such as stream depletions, recognizing that monitoring is going to be a key focus of GSP development and implementation as well. The model could also be considered for evaluation of projects and management actions, so basically looking at if there is a proposed recharge project or some augmentation of surface water supplies, how might that affect groundwater conditions? Some of the things that we see having the potential for future work or future need are to refine the characterization of the western boundary, so along the Sacramento River. The model ends at that point or at that boundary, and so through collaboration with neighboring basins and regional models that cover both sides of the river, there's probably an opportunity to better understand those exchanges along the western boundary with the Sacramento River and the neighboring basins. Also incorporation of the AEM project that's been underway and nearing completion to refine the hydrogeologic characterization, perhaps better understand recharge areas and mechanisms within the basin. And then consider updates to support annual GSP reporting during implementation. So there are certain components of the water budgets that will need to be reported on an annual basis once the GSP is adopted. And the model may be a good tool to do that. It's something that would need further evaluation. So let me stop there. I think I saw at least one hand raised, and this would be a good point for discussion.
Yes, Jim, your hand's raised.
Okay, I'm unmuted.
Yeah.
The slide 14 shows the stream flow hydrographs, and I can't tell by the map exactly where these locations are, but I know from looking at Big Chico Creek over the years, as streams flow through the basin toward the river, they move over layers with variable permeability overlying stream aquitards. Some streams flow underground when the gravel's deep enough, and then reemerge when the overlying gravel is shallow. At least that's what I'm interpreting when I see the stream disappear and then come back to the surface. So I'm wondering how the stream gauge locations are chosen in order to account for this variable stream flow that's observed as it flows through the basin.
May I answer that? This is Reza. You know, for stream flows, these are the locations that we have the data, but the behavior of the streams as far as, you know, where it's losing or gaining, we have looked at, there is no detailed data on that one for many of these streams, but what we could do was looking at the groundwater levels near the bay, near the streams, and along the length of the streams, we looked at where the groundwaters are showing that there is gaining and losing streams nearby. So we try to match the behavior of the streams and adjust the stream bed conductance so the stream would behave similarly in the model as far as the gaining and losing.
Thank you. And one other comment that Byron made about identifying potential recharge areas within the basin. Without a really comprehensive view of the recharge mechanism, what concerns me about putting so much energy into identifying potential recharge areas within the basin is the attempt to do artificial recharge within the basin, which is something we've discussed earlier in the meeting, having to do with some of the consequences associated with artificial recharge. So I just want to make sure that we maintain a broad spectrum of recharge areas and not just look at potential recharge areas within the basin. It's really important for scientific and political reasons to do that. Thank you.
Jim, thank you. And Bruce, I see Bruce Smith, I see you have your hand up.
Yeah, I would have expected to see some well log data and possibly cross sections. And I know I saw, I think it was on page 15, where they referenced the AEM study and under the impression that you could do cross sections on that. And I would like to see in the future when they do these modeling that they include the cross sections that are going to have to be used someday. And I think Sigma requires at least two cross sections. I'm assuming this model does use cross sections. And also, does this model do flow paths? Thank you.
Would you like to comment on the HCM, Christina, and how that fits in to the integrated hydrologic model?
Yes. So one of the, that's right, one of the hard components of that HCM, hydrogeologic conceptual model section of the GSP is our cross sections. And so that will be coming to you probably next time or in the next meeting or two. But maybe Reza can then respond to how the model deals with, you know, cross sections in the model are going to look different and be probably less detailed than our geologic cross sections that we can put together with AEM and other well log information. But Reza, can you respond to the second half there? Flow paths.
Yes, you know, the during the calibration, one of the things that we looked at was the flow paths in the basin and how the groundwater is moving from the higher elevations on the east side toward the Sacramento River. And we have groundwater flow from east to west and also from northeast to southwest in the basin. And we try to simulate that condition in the model. And until we had that flow system correct in the model, the wells were not calibrating as well, you know, but once we made the model to simulate that flow path and that flow condition in the groundwater, then a lot of wells fell right on top of this observed values, and we had a very good calibration once we had the flow system correct. And we looked at the contour maps and the water levels to make sure we have the flow path correct.
Does that answer your question, Bruce?
Partially, and I think it's probably something that's coming. One of my current concerns is going to be in tying this back into defining recharge areas. Someday in the future, and possibly outside of our basin, with our neighbors, there's going to be some production wells that are going to be turned on and could have dramatic impact on us. And it's going to be necessary, and it sounds like you're headed that way, to have, if not detailed in this model, maybe some smaller models that are designed to track that. So my concern is that that we start to see in these presentations some well log data and just some pictures of cross sections, so that people get the idea of what's coming. I see an awful lot of hydrographs, which are great, but they're just part of the picture. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Are there any other questions or comments about the model calibration part of the presentation? Members of the public, any comments or questions? Okay, Byron.
Okay, yeah, the next thing we'd like to do is to talk a little bit about the groundwater conditions in the basin and specifically look at some more hydrographs for selected wells within the basin. And with this, I'd like to ask David Miller with GEI to describe some of the work that his firm has done to support this effort and pull together some of these key hydrographs.
Thank you, Byron. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So to start out with a little introduction here, what we're going to be showing are hydrographs from key wells that were actually referenced in the table that Reza showed. And these are showing historical groundwater levels, and these key wells were selected because they have kind of consistent, good, complete periods of record. The data is believed to be of high quality, and so they are reliable sources of information. And the locations are shown on this map right here, and then in the next series of slides, we'll be focusing in on each of the three management areas and showing hydrographs for the wells shown on this slide for those that are located in each particular management area. And the trends for the individual wells provide some insight into aquifer conditions over the period of record shown on these hydrographs. One thing just to, I'm sure you're all aware of this, but to point out, is that these hydrographs are elevations based on mean sea level. So they're not depths to ground surface or depths below ground surface. And so they're useful in developing contours and basically seeing flow directions because they're based on this uniform datum mean sea level. But another purpose for these is their relation to the ground surface, which are not shown in these hydrographs. But you can have, for instance, some wells that are deeper relative to mean sea level, but are actually closer to the ground surface. And so it's those wells that are close to the ground surface that may support GDEs or be important in groundwater stream flow interactions. Okay, so Byron, next. Okay, so these are some hydrographs from the Vining North management area. And three of them are for wells where there's a single monitoring well at the location. And then two of them are for locations where they're nested wells. And so you can see in each of those four different sort of screen depths that are monitored. And so you can see the relation between the aquifer, the groundwater surfaces at each of those wells in the nested locations. And what you see here is that really the groundwater elevations are pretty consistent. There's a good bit of seasonal fluctuation, but the scales on these are all consistent, so you can kind of observe how much variation there is from well to well. And then also you can see how for the nested wells, for the most part, regardless of the depth of the screen in each of the wells, they track pretty closely. Okay, so anything, Christina, you would like to add about this?
No, I don't think so, thanks.
Okay, good, all right. So any questions on this slide for Vina North?
SHAC members, I'll start with you and then go to members of the public. So if you have any questions, please, or comments, please raise your hand, SHAC members. Jim, I see your hand is up.
Yeah, Mr. Miller, I really appreciate you describing the difference between the elevation and the depth from the surface. And in the future, I would like to see the depth from the surface axis over on the right-hand side, because it is, as you mentioned, so important for interaction with stream and groundwater-dependent ecosystems. Also, I'd like you to make sure everyone understands the concept of a pressurized aquifer. I had an online discussion with Dr. Buck about the potentiometric surface and how in the way these in the nested wells, how they seem to track each other. It does seem like there is connectivity with the shallower, the intermediate, and the deep aquifer having to do with the, at least this is the way I see it, with the potential, the pressure, the potentiometric pressure of the deep aquifer. Because some people don't quite get how can this deep aquifer have the same level. And since it's in a confining layer, the water level is actually down under the confining layer, but the potential of the water is what these hydrographs are measuring. So I just want to make sure members of the public and members of the SHAC are up to speed on the importance of recognizing how a pressurized water aquifer system works. It's so dynamic. Thank you.
Good, okay. Thanks, Jim. And noted, those are good observations.
And thank you, Jim. And Ann Dawson, member of the SHAC.
I'd just like an explanation of what a nested well is.
Yeah, it's there are different kinds of construction, but in general, it means that at the same location, you have wells that are dedicated monitoring wells. Their purpose is to monitor at different levels at a location. So you can see that the depths on each of these wells, each of these lines are shown, and that they the screened interval is, or the screen in each well is located at a place so it can monitor groundwater levels at a different depth in that single spot, really. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure. Is that somehow related to the little box on the graph that says 5 meters depth or 4M depth?
The designation M is confusing because it makes you think it means meters. It doesn't. It's just at that location, there is a well that's designated as 5, 4, 3, and 2, meaning 4 separate wells. There may have been a 1 at one point, but it's not, you know, it's not operational at this point. And then next to those M designations and the colored lines are the depth at which that well is monitoring. And you can see there's quite a range among the four in each of the two sets of nested wells.
Thank you.
Christina, did you have something to add?
I think that's good. Maybe just to point out, like, the one in the bottom left there, 23 North 1 West 31 M, has 4, and that's a good example also of what Jim was talking about. So this is a well that is monitoring, you know, in one location, 4 different zones kind of in the whole aquifer system. And you can see the blue line is the shallow. It's only 106 feet deep, and it's that top line. It's a bit different, right? So it's more what's going on in the shallow aquifer system. It's probably water table, unconfined conditions, and it's right by the Sacramento River. So it's probably also affected at times by what's going on in the river. And then in the deeper zones, they seem to track together, but they also diverge at times. And so those are examples of this pressurized aquifer system that's either semi-confined or confined. And water levels, even though it's at the same kind of location on the map, they're different depths. And so different depths of the aquifer do have different conditions, water level conditions, because of pumping that may be occurring nearby or recharge dynamics at different times. So that's just a good example of some of these things that are being talked about.
Thank you, Christina. Any other members of the SHAC have any questions of David about what David has presented? And just going to members of the public, any questions about David's presentation so far? Thank you, David.
Okay, so Byron, can we step on to the next one?
Byron?
Oh, Byron?
I think he's frozen.
Yeah.
Is he frozen? Oh.
There we go. Maybe, no.
Oh, we lost him.
Yeah.
Okay. He'll probably call back in, but let me call up the presentation. Just one moment. Byron, are you back? I was just...
Yes, I'm back. I'm sorry, my internet connection went down temporarily.
Oh, that's okay. I was just about to call up the presentation. Do you want to go ahead and share again?
Yes.
Thank you for your patience, everyone.
Okay, let's see. So, yeah, all right. So this is a similar set for the Bonny Chico management area. And the, you know, the same kind of observations about what these wells measure. And again, you can see that the water levels are over time fairly consistent. There are some big spikes in up and down in the O3 well, and I'm not sure about the reasons for those, but and you can see a little bit of decline in some of the wells during the the last number of years, and then you can see for the nested well how closely those different wells track. And in the interest of time, I think let's just move to the next one before I ask for questions. And then here is for Bonny South management area. And an interesting thing here is the nested well in the upper right and how you have two wells that track almost identically. I mean, they're really indistinguishable. And then the shallower well has water surface elevations that are quite distinct from the other two deeper wells. So any questions about these last two slides.
I don't see any hands. Go ahead,
Dave. Okay, so Byron, and then so all the information you've seen up to this point, really in this presentation, helps in assessing groundwater level contours and flow directions. And these are, you know, going back to the fact that the datum for these hydrocarbons. Hang on, let me get my. Sorry, another Zoom interruption. But anyway, since the datum is mean sea level, they can be used, these groundwater elevations, to construct contour maps, which show groundwater elevations over the area, and then also can be used to look at flow directions. So, Byron, next. And so this is a pair of maps from spring 2015 and fall 2015, showing the difference in elevations, the spring being the period really before the irrigation season has begun, and then the fall being the period after the irrigation, after the summer has ended, and so peak water demands and extraction from the groundwater is slowing down for the year. And so this shows how both groundwater elevations and then flow directions change from the spring to the fall of this year. And then Byron, let's go to the next slide. And this is the same comparison. The difference is that here the year we're looking at is 2019. And so again, this shows the difference between spring and fall. And then another comparison you can make is between spring of 2015 and fall and spring of 2019, for example. So this is just illustrative of what we're seeing based on DWR data for groundwater elevations and for the flow directions that one derives from those elevations. Okay, any questions or observations about this set of slides?
Yes, I see, Jim, your hand is raised.
Yes, this is a question that I communicated with Christina about, asking if the flow directions for the shallow, the intermediate, and deep aquifer zones would be similar. I'm not clear as to what if these flow directions are measuring one or the other of those. And Christina mentioned to me that she thought that they would be quite similar, that the vertical gradients are relatively small, but these flow gradients are based on measurements of which layer of the aquifer, do you know?
I can't answer that, precisely, but they are, from, again, they're from DWR data. They're not deep layers of the aquifer, but as you saw from most of the nested hydrographs, there's good communication between the different depths. And so I think this supports Christina's response to you that generally the flow directions at different depths follow the same path.
So you think they're just averaging some of the data from the nested wells to come up with the contours?
I let me dig into that a little bit more, Jim, before I answer that. Christina, do you, are you, are you familiar with, are you able to answer Jim's question?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure either. I mean, I think the question is, right, in those points where we've got three or four different numbers, which of them are used? And I guess the question would be, does it matter? And in which locations would it matter? That might help too. And I don't know those questions, but those are good things to kind of tease out.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the flow is showing the lateral flows, and it doesn't, I don't think there's been any effort really to identify vertical flows. I don't know how important that is, but I suspect it has, I suspect that it may be an important factor in the dynamics of how the aquifer operates. So I'd be curious to know if there are any vertical flow data.
And I looked at that some in looking at identifying kind of the principal aquifers. And so we can kind of revisit that. There are some vertical flow gradients as we saw in those previous hydrographs. They're pretty small, but they're also complicated in some locations because they change in time, you know, between recharge kind of recovery time in the winter and irrigation season. So there are some interesting patterns to pull out and understand, and we can continue to do that.
Excellent. And in other words, vertical flow could either be going up or down depending on where the pressure is. So.
Where and then even at a particular location, sometimes it goes up and sometimes it goes down in some cases.
Yes. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, Dave, are you continuing?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it for me, but it does, Christina's answer about the vertical flows, one of the reasons we selected those particular sets of nested wells is that they do illustrate the, in most cases, the connection between the different layers. And in one case in particular, kind of a disconnection. So it's they're meant to illustrate the vertical point that you're asking about, Jim.
Thank you, Dave. And so Byron, let me ask you, given the amount of time that we have, I mean, clearly we're going to need to spend more time on the groundwater conditions than we have. So in the next sort of 7 minutes, let's just be realistic about what we can do here. Byron, you're on mute.
Thank you, Tanya. Yes, yeah, I had hoped to be able to cover this section, but I think that's probably not practical. So let's look for a good stopping point along the way.
Sounds good. Thank you.
And you'll have to help me with time. I don't have a clock next to me, and I can't see my computer's clock with the presentation open.
Yes, well, we'll want to stop in 10 minutes, and I'll let you know. I'll give you a 5-minute warning. Mm-hmm.
So, The historical water budget is, basically just accounting for water coming into the system and leaving the system over time, as well as any change in storage within the system. And so we can think of it like a bank account where the deposits minus the withdrawals equal the change in balance in the account. In other words, the inflows minus the outflows equal the change in storage. And the water budgets developed under SGMA using the Butte Basin groundwater model include the land surface. So you can think of the root zone across agricultural, urban, native, different land use types, as well as the surface water system. So streams and so on, surface water bodies within the basin, as well as the groundwater system, the aquifer system itself. And the historical water budgets help provide us insight into how the system has worked in the recent past, and how different drivers of the water budgets may have affected groundwater conditions that have been observed in the form of hydrographs or other information. Based on DWR's best management practices and the GSP regulations, the water budget can kind of be simplified into this diagram that shows the different exchanges, basically inflows to and outflows from the basin, which is represented by the black box, as well as the exchanges between the land and surface water system and the groundwater system. And so primary components are surface water inflows and outflows, precipitation, evapotranspiration or consumptive use, and then subsurface inflows, so interbasin flows and subsurface outflows to neighboring basins. And then these exchanges between the surface layer and the groundwater system in the form of groundwater pumping, stream losses, or water basically moving from the stream, seeping to or leaking to the groundwater system, stream accretions, so in areas where the groundwater level adjacent to a stream is higher than the stage of the stream, then water can actually move naturally from the groundwater system into the stream and increase stream flow, and then deep percolation, so that would be vertical recharge on the land surface that ultimately reaches the aquifer system. And then because of the way the Butte Basin model is set up with the western boundary not extending past the Sacramento River, rather than try to separate out the surface water groundwater interaction along the river versus the interbasin flows from neighboring basins right now, we have included those together to estimate a net outflow along the western boundary. And that's an area that, you know, that needs additional refinement and additional understanding, again, probably in the context of interbasin coordination and the use of broader regional models that cover both sides of the river. The reporting requirements will require additional detail beyond what is shown in this figure that will be included in the GSP. For example, reporting water use by water use sector. So what is the consumptive use of agricultural lands versus native lands versus wetlands versus urban and industrial lands, et cetera. So there'll be further breakout in the plan itself. So I'm just gonna skip through this, but basically the inflows, the outflows, the exchanges, and then the change in storage are the kind of the key groups of water budget components that are included in the GSP. So I'll try to get through this section just to kind of describe some of the primary water budget drivers in the basin historically, including land use, precipitation, evapotranspiration, surface water supplies, groundwater pumping, percolation, surface water groundwater interaction, and then the interbasin flows. And I think that's probably all we'll be able to cover for today. So I have a series of bar charts that I'll show covering each of these components. The first one being for land use, the basin is roughly 45% irrigated agriculture, about 13% developed, primarily in the Chico area, and 42% native vegetation, with native vegetation including grasslands and riparian. There's also a small amount of wetlands in the basin as well. And so this figure shows those changes over time. Some of the key things I think to point out are that the agricultural area has remained relatively consistent overall. Some reduction in rice estimated in recent years as a result of curtailment and transfers, as well as the wet winters that have resulted in what's called preventative planting, where farmers don't plant all their fields because it's too wet in the spring. Somewhat of an increase in orchards from maybe around 55 to 60,000 acre feet, around 2000 to around 60 to 65,000 acre feet in recent years. Certainly not as large an increase as we've seen in other areas. And that's typically through the reduction in other crops, some idle land, some growth in developed lands, although that's in part due to changes in how DWR has delineated developed lands over time. They've added more detail in their more recent crop surveys in terms of delineating individual roads and things like that. So it's not strictly due to increased development. To some extent, it's just a change in how those land use surveys have been developed.
Byron, just a just under 5 minutes left.
Okay. So the point on this graph, this shows precipitation in thousands of acre feet per year over the historical water budget reporting period from 2000 to 2018. And the point here to make is that on average, precipitation is about 27 inches in the basin, but highly variable from year to year. Evapotranspiration is relatively consistent over time, with some increases in some of the hotter, drier years, just due to increased evaporative demand. Also influenced somewhat by agricultural land use over time. So years when there might be less cropping, that can affect the overall ET as well. And so that's an average of about 24 inches per year. Water supplies are primarily groundwater in the basin, with agricultural groundwater use estimated to make up about 82% of the total supplies. Urban groundwater use estimated to make up about 10%, and then surface water diversions about 8%. And the surface water diversions are used for agriculture. And they average about 17.1 inches when spread over the entire basin. Percolation, if you think back to the precipitation graph, percolation really mirrors precipitation largely in the basin. You tend to have relatively similar percolation from the agricultural lands over time, but variability in natural recharge, both, I guess, on the ag lands and on the native lands. Recall that native lands make up a substantial portion of the basin, so we think that that's a significant portion of the recharge. And when you start to look at trends in estimated groundwater storage over time, they really do mirror the precipitation and the percolation. Surface water, groundwater interaction. So this is a bit of a confusing graph, I think. On the positive axis, we have seepage and stream losses or leakage from streams that traverse the basin over time, somewhat variable. On the negative axis, we have stream accretions. So these are estimated as water coming back to the streams from the groundwater system. And you could see in the stream accretions somewhat of a decrease over this period, particularly starting in about 2007 when we got into the drought years. And so somewhat of a change over time based on this historical period. But net water movement from streams, canals, and drains to the groundwater system of about 20,000 acre feet per year. And here's just a look at those annual values for the creeks that traverse the basin. So we have Angel Slough, Big Chico Creek, Butte Creek, Dry Creek, Little Chico Creek, et cetera. And so on net, the greatest seepage from streams is from Butte Creek, followed by Big Chico Creek, Little Dry Creek, and Rock Creek, as currently estimated by the model. And actually net accretions in Angel Slough, Mud Creek, Pine Creek, and Singer Creek. And so one important point to make here is that whether or not a stream is leaking or gaining depends on where you're at along the stream and when you're there. It will vary with time, kind of getting back to Jim's point about water reemerging in the streams, downstream of sections that may be dry. So there are those dynamics to consider as well. So moving on to interbasin flows. So these are net interbasin flows of about 67,000 acre feet per year. And so the inflows include the foothill area, so sort of your Sierra foothill mountain front recharge.
Byron?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I think we have a question from Samantha Lewis, and then I think we're going to have to find a way to just wrap this up for today. And of course, this is an unfinished conversation. We realize that. So first to Samantha, and then I'll just turn back to you, Byron, for final word here.
Okay. Samantha?
Yeah, thank you. I realize we're running out of time. Because the budget really is based on these inflows, and I understand that the SGMA legislation doesn't cover the foothills, but considering how important the area appears to be for recharging our basin, what kind of recommendations should we be considering for the GSA? I mean, while VINA doesn't appear to have authority over the area, Should the GSA be making zoning requests or recommendations to the county and the city of Chico?
That's a policy question. I think it certainly understanding the dynamics of recharge along the edge of the basin is important. The model does include areas to the east of the Vina subbasin up into the foothills, and so it does estimate, you know, infiltration and percolation and subsurface flows coming in from the foothill area, and they're about 50,000 acre feet per year based on our current estimates. So I think understanding that is certainly important. Christina, do you want to comment on, you know, past work that's been done? I think, you know, one thing that would be helpful would be perhaps to establish more stream gauges along the streams that flow in from the foothills to better understand what that runoff from the Sierras is.
It looks like Paul might like to follow up for Butte County. Paul?
Sure. Now, I was just not going to answer from the technical point on how to improve inflows from the foothills and the mountains, but Samantha had a good point that the GSA does not have jurisdiction or SGMA authority outside of the basin, but this had come up repeatedly in a number of different areas, including the county, about, hey, recharge is important in the areas outside the basin, and that's where county, particularly county land use, plays a role, and that's going to be at least summarized in the plan about what the land use of the county and the municipalities are, and that would give the Shack an opportunity to weigh in if there are policy recommendations needed on that, that'll be part of the discussion of GSP development. So
mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Paul. And Samantha, I see you have lowered your hand. So Jim, a final concise thought here since we are running low on time.
Yes, I was, I wanted to know, in the evapotranspiration graph that includes wildland acres as native vegetation, is the unirrigated urban forest, the street and non-riparian park trees, are these considered native, developed, or otherwise in your evapotranspiration analysis?
You know, I would need to review the DWR land use surveys in a bit more detail. It may be a bit of a mix. I think generally speaking, they would be included in the urban land use, certainly land. But when you get to very large vegetated areas sort of within the urban footprint, some of those may be classified as native.
Well, I'm talking a lot about the street trees. I understand how you would break out portions of Bidwell Park as being a native vegetation, but the streets of Chico are well known for their large unirrigated trees, and there must be a lot of evapotranspiration there. So it's something that I want to make sure we include in our analysis. And I had one comment to make on stream accretion. The negative, first of all, the idea of assigning a stream accretion a negative value, I want to make sure that the public doesn't misinterpret that as being a negative value. Stream accretion is a really important positive value. But the negative accretion values assigned to Mud Creek just don't correlate with my observation of stream dewaterings, that the small streams are dewatered early in almost every season. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious to know how that was designated as being a stream that gains from groundwater when during at least 6 months out of the year, these streams run dry once they hit the valley floor and go into recharge groundwater. They flow out through the foothills, through the canyons, and then when they hit the valley floor, oftentimes they're dry. So I'm just curious about how that is assigned a negative value.
Yes, I think what you probably see in, you know, starting to dig into some of the monthly estimates of these values is that, you know, the stream flows are zero, you know, during the summer period, and it's during the winter that you start to get some water, you know, estimated to return to the stream from the groundwater system when those groundwater levels are high. But it's a very dynamic process in reality, and you know, the model tries to capture that.
Well, as long as the model is understanding that these streams are being dewatered, when historically, according to evidence that I've talked to some old timers, these streams used to be perennial streams that, that would support native fish populations. And now Rock Creek, Pine Creek, Mud Creek, these streams go underground because the aquifer is lower than it used to be. It used to support these streams. There used to be actual stream accretion year round, and there isn't anymore. So that's really an important consideration for the historic conditions and perhaps setting future future goals.
Thank you, Jim. Byron, I think, could I ask you to stop sharing your screen? And then I'm going to ask you to weigh in as well as Christina when we look at, thank you, when we look at our meeting framework, which appears on the third page of the agenda, which we keep up to date, and we update this every month. Or every time we have a meeting, just to let you know sort of where we are and where we're going to the best of our ability. And before we get into then a quick debrief, I think this is a good place to sort of check in based on, you know, today and how, you know, far we got. We didn't get through this discussion. Christina and Byron, any thoughts about where we might start the next conversation?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts. So there was some conversation today around the hydrogeologic conceptual model. I'm wondering if maybe next time we should go there a little bit and then follow that with the rest of the water budget information, historical and scenarios. And I think that will be a lot to cover also, but that might be a good path forward just in terms of content. I think just to give folks an idea too, we do have David's engineering contract for the basin setting project ends at the end of June, and we are getting ready. The Board of Supervisors will consider a contract with GeoSyntec at their May 26th meeting, I believe. So GeoSyntec will be working on the rest of the development of the GSPs, and they'll be taking up the information and content that's been developed under the Basin Setting Project and moving forward with that. So I think with the monitoring network topic, that's one of those things that is really supporting basin setting work in that it's the monitoring network that we have to use right now that informs our groundwater conditions, you know, groundwater levels and other things. But it then becomes an important piece of GSP completion because it's also going to support in an important way development of sustainable management criteria. So I think that probably fits better moving into that conversation in terms of SMC's sustainable management criteria a little bit further down the road. So I would suggest that we, you're going to continue to see kind of evidence of the monitoring network as we talk about these other topics because it's really the backbone of them, but it will continue to be an important backbone of SMC development in the future as well, and I think we could probably hit it more directly in that context in a really important way. So those are a couple of my thoughts. I think we should try to hit these next big pieces, hydrogeologic conceptual model and water budget, in June.
Okay, so we will revisit and continue our discussion of the current historical groundwater conditions and water budget and see if we can also cover the HCM, given for the technical components of the work, given that we've already talked about how we will be agendizing, bringing back the out-of-basin transfer discussion, as well as some process pieces associated with decision-making and the charter. So we'll need to stop there so we have at least 5 minutes to hear the Shaq sort of comments. I'd like a quick, because even though we spent a lot of time at the top of the meeting talking about concerns associated with meeting using these sorts of formats, including some of the challenges as well as benefits, that some people's perspectives is that there are benefits because it does allow for more people to participate. I'd like to hear more from the SHAC members about sort of what worked well with using Zoom. What are you continue to feel concerned about in using an online format for these meetings, and really trying to tease out what you think is possible for us to do in this video conferencing format. As we didn't get through the presentation, but was it working for the sharing of information? Because basin setting is still the sharing of information and we're not getting to formal recommendations. So I want to ask the SHAC member sort of what worked, what didn't work? Can you see continuing to use Zoom for information sharing? Could you please raise your hands if you'd like to make a comment? It would be great to hear from each of the SHAC members if possible. Cherie?
I enjoy the online format. I think the content is delivered well. We have opportunity for chatting with one another, voting. So I'm okay with this moving forward as long as we need to.
Thank you, Cherie. I appreciate that. David Kane with Cal Water, your thoughts?
I think it worked well. As long as we keep on time, I think it was a good format.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, David. Cherie, did you have a follow-up or is your hand just still up there? Okay. Thank you. David, yes, you can lower your hand. I see, Jim, your hand is up. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I want to, let Dave and Byron and Christina know how much I appreciate all the effort they put into making the presentations and answering the questions and engaging in the conversations. It's really, that's very effective. I really enjoy that, and it's happening for me in both Zoom and in personal. But the lack of participation by the great number of people that are signed on to this make me question how engaged the participants actually are. I'm concerned that people may be distracted by other things that may be going on in their house or on the online and the phones. If we're sitting in a room with each other, people are not usually sitting with their phones, scrolling through their phones or whatever. So I'm unclear whether the number of people we see on this are actually participating. I don't know that private chat conversations are appropriate during these public meetings. They certainly wouldn't be if we were sitting in a room. You wouldn't have people off in a corner chatting to each other. So I don't know how appropriate that is for what is in effect a public meeting. So those are two of my critiques for Zoom meetings. Also, that how our discussions get so truncated at the end. This is happening whether we're meeting in public or meeting in Zoom, and that's disappointing that we rush in the end of these conversations, because I've got more questions, but I don't want to. I see we're at noon right now, and I know that you like to be on time, Tanya. So. Those are my comments on today's meeting and these meetings in general.
Thank you, Jim. Gary, I see you've been waiting. Gary Cole. You'll need to get off mute, Gary. Thank you.
I agree with the comments previously made here already. One thing that was irritating for me, I like to print off these presentations, and then I have my booklet and I can go back and refer to the information being given. If we are going, for those of us that printed this, and also we saw some of it on the screen, The problem is that using the PowerPoint and then we're to print from that, I have to have gallons of paint for my printer in order to do it. I would like the format to be changed a little bit on from the format used for the PowerPoint, if it could. In other words, some of those pages are all blue background. Excuse me. And the only thing that's not blue is where the three or four words are. And the only, that's the reason the words show up, because they're not blue. So I'm printing a whole blue page. In fact, as anyone else that printed them, we printed 61 of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can help with that, both in how the actual presentation is built, and then maybe to help you figure out how to print out the presentation in grayscale and using the worksheet function in PowerPoint, which allows you to print more than one screen per page. And so we can follow up with you and both work on making them simpler so they don't use so much ink, and also helping with some of the technology if you would be open to that, Gary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. And Bruce, and then Anne. Bruce?
Yeah. The meeting got through maybe half of what was designed on the agenda. And it seems to me on other things, because of this coronavirus, it's taking 2-3 times as long to do anything. So I would strongly recommend that the state or whoever is in charge of this extend those deadlines a long ways down the road, because we're not even getting through maybe a third of what we should. And
Bruce, you're frozen. Can you turn off your video? And it might allow us to hear you.
Sure. Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Couple of things. We didn't get through maybe a half or a third of this presentation. So I'd strongly suggest that we, or the state, whoever's in charge of it, extend the deadlines a long ways down the road, because if this is how it's going to be, it's going to take 2-3 times as long as we thought. I do appreciate Tanya, you and Christine and each of the others that made presentations. I thought the interaction between questions was good, but this is nothing like meeting in person. And it really leaves a lot to be desired. Nothing to do with you, Tanya, or Christine, or anyone. It is just Zoom, as good as it may be, doesn't cut it in my world. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Bruce. Anne, your thoughts?
Hi. I think there's a generation gap going on here. We of the gray hair are not used to doing a lot of stuff online, typing and so on. I personally thought that the presentation of technical information went very well on Zoom, but I don't think that the discussion we had for the first hour, I would prefer to undertake that in a room with everyone. I'm wondering if compromise, if we continue to have a low incidence of COVID in the area, might be that the SHEC members meet in the room in the city hall with appropriate spacing, whereas the public are given the opportunity to attend via Zoom or anyone else who's comfortable with that. My last comment would be that there's no guarantee that we won't be dealing with COVID this time next year. And so trying to delay a lot of the meetings is, in my opinion, not the best idea, just an opinion.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you for coming up with various possible solutions. That's very helpful. Samantha?
Yeah, just to follow up to Anne. Anne, this isn't a generation gap issue. I think that this has to do with needing to build trust in our community and being able to come out at the end of this fully representing what the community is feeling and thinking and needing. So I agree with you, but don't blame yourself here. This is a format that works for disseminating information, but in terms of building trust, it's really difficult unless we're actually in the room together. I agree with you, and I like your ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that, Samantha. Any other members of the SHAC who have yet to speak, who would like to weigh in, provide your input? And then any thoughts from the public? And then I'll go to our members of the management committee to see if you have a final thoughts. Any comments, debriefing comments from members of the public? Thank you. Let me ask the management committee, members of the management committee, if you have any final thoughts before we wrap up today's meeting. Okay, hearing
none. We'll try, given all of those comments and our kind of progress today, I think we'll have to be really careful about not overloading the agenda next time. And probably what I described in doing the HCM and the water budget stuff is too much. So we'll wrestle with that and see what we can come up with.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks, Christina. And I very much appreciate everyone's participation today and your forbearance with this really difficult situation. I'm glad that we had time at the top of the agenda to really air some of those concerns, because I think that we've gotten good information about how we can adapt to these circumstances and sort of improve the process. And we look forward to being in touch with you about how we'd like to proceed. We will proceed in June is what I'm sort of gathering, sort of how we do that, whether if we can do something like Anne suggested, you know, we may be reaching out and getting your more thoughts on that from the SHAC. Okay, thank you all, and thank you for staying over. We look forward to being in touch. Take care.
Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
Hey, Linda, are you still there?
I'm here, sorry. So hard with not the having the speakerphone.
That's okay, how are you?
Okay, yeah.
So okay. Yeah, okay, I just saw you still here. I thought I would check in, see how you're doing.
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I just figured out technology myself. I don't have a speaker on my computer. I can hear, but I can't talk. So that's why. So, but anyway, but good job. We'll figure that out. You know, it's interesting. just the only thing I.
I'm sorry, Linda. Mariana, could you just stop recording? Thanks.